Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 181 for September 7th, 2011. Live Cloud. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week the big projects, the little projects, the hidden projects, the well-known projects, all sorts of great projects about open source, about people getting together, contributing, making great stuff together in collaboration, cooperation. By the way, this is not a show about dental hygiene. So if you're a dentist tuning into this show, trying to figure out why people have poor flossing habits, this is not about Flossing Weekly. This is about Floss, free Libre open source software weekly. Actually came up in last week's Linux Outlaws show, so I had to bring it up today. Speaking of Linux Outlaws show, I'm going to rebring on, that doesn't even make sense, my wonderful co-host Dan Lynch. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be here. For a minute there, I thought you said you were going to reboot me, but you didn't actually say that. Sometimes I need a reboot when I start to slow down and I run out of memory. Sometimes I need a reboot. It's great to be back. I mean, last time I was here, I think you said when we finished, I don't know when you'll be back on, but I will get you on again. And here I am on the very next show. So I just hang around and you can't get rid of me.
Well, that's how wacky my scheduling is. I really should have this all planned out months in advance, but no, I basically, for those at home that don't know this, I pretty much get the co-host for the next show like right about 2 days before the show. I should be a little bit better at that, but hey, it all works. We are here. This is the important part, right? And mm-hmm. By the way, if you're watching the video, you wouldn't be able to see it on the audio because there's no seeing, but you'll recognize behind me is that great, wonderful Mount Hood icon. Not an icon. What is it? Stained glass. There it is. Well, I guess this is iconic. This is the last time you're ever going to see this. I'm moving out of this house in the next 2 weeks, so I will not be here anymore. The stained glass will be gone. I'm taking the big blue Yeti with me, though, so that'll probably be on future shows. Just won't be here in this wonderful room that I have. So I'm using the big blue Yeti, but we will be using it in new locations after that. And also, I'm a little dazed and confused still. I had an incredibly great time down at Dragon Con over the last weekend. If you watched my tweets or my Google Plus messages or whatever, you saw that I was just everywhere and all over, especially Foursquare Chickens. If you watch all the different buildings, I kept going back and forth. I kept checking in each time. I became mayor of the green room. That was so cool. So there's a special green room for just the guests. I added it as a place to check in. And I checked in like two times. I got the mayorship on Foursquare. And somebody else stole it from me the next day. So I had to steal it back. But it's mine again. Mine, all mine. So that was a lot of fun. And a lot of you came up to me at the show at DragonCon and said hello and told me how much you appreciate Floss Weekly. And I appreciate that sort of feedback because that's what's helped me keep pushing through the show and doing all the things I have to do, the volunteer time I have to spend to make this thing happen, you know, probably 5 or 6 hours a week to make this go. Speaking of the show, I mean, we're not just here to chat, you and I, Dan. We actually have a guest coming on today. Really interesting project, LibCloud, being represented by the project leader, or at least one of the key committers, Tomas Muras, who is, I believe, from Slovenia, which is out in the middle of Europe somewhere. I don't know. I'm a geographically challenged American, so I don't know exactly where. I think I've been there, though, before. So we'll have to check out exactly where that is when we bring our guest on. But so LibCloud, from what I could tell from the documentation, is first off, it's an Apache project. So it has a lot of the support from being part of the Apache Foundation. But also what it does is it sits between your application and all the different APIs that all of these cloud providers have. So, for example, the Amazon EC2 interface is slightly different from the Rackspace interface, which is slightly different from the next guy and the next guy and the next guy. And to try to isolate that so that your program can just use one common set of calls to talk to all these different things, that's what it's for. So we'll actually have to get a much better explanation as we bring on our guest, as we often do. So any thoughts on that, Dan?
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I have quite a big interest in Python. I'm not much of a Python developer these days, but I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this goes, because obviously the cloud is where it's at these days. It's a buzz term, so we've all got to get on there and get used to it as well.
Yep. But before we bring on our guest, very, very important, I have to say, is that we have a sponsor today. I love it when we have sponsors because I get to read all this wonderful text copy. If I can bring up my preview sheet. There we go. Okay, so there we go. Great. So this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. Now, I have a Mac laptop, and I'm sitting in a hotel. I'm pulling up Netflix all the time, watching shows that way, depending on the speed of the Wi-Fi, of course. Sometimes it's a little bit too slow for that. You can also watch on your iPhone and some Android phones, too. I watch on my iPhone. A great application for that. Sometimes I'm actually watching it while I'm in public transit. I'm like picking up on a television show that I haven't finished yet. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. I have a PS3. It looks beautiful on there. The interface is very good. I can get to shows really nice. In fact, it's better than some of the other standard interfaces. And if you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box. They're inexpensive and easy to use. I've now had three generations of Roku. The Roku 2 is beautiful. It does a full 1080p with Netflix. And I tell you, the stuff just comes through amazingly clear. I've just takes full advantage of my big screen TV here at home. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. And you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and then finish on a different one. That's the really great part, is I can start watching and I don't have to remember like oh, it's 47 minutes in. It just remembers for me. So works out really nice that way. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So try Netflix today for 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. That's TWIT. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial, netflix.com/twit, so that they know that we sent them to you. No, they know that we sent you to them. There we go. One of those pronouns. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Tomas, welcome to the show.
Hey, Randall. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, actually. Where are you speaking to us from in that sort of slightly backlit room? If you're not watching the video, you won't get this. But where are you speaking to us from?
I'm currently at my home in Maribor, Slovenia. So that's like Central Europe.
Wow. I've been sort of around that area. I haven't actually been that close. In fact, I'm heading out that direction towards the... I'm heading to Black Sea, actually, in about 6 weeks. So that'll be fun. So somewhere in that general direction, I guess. So I gave a... sort of a brief overview, at least the amount that I could get from reading the website for 15 minutes in the beginning of the show about what LiveCloud is. But why don't you go ahead and fill us in about what LiveCloud is, what does it accomplish, and what problem is it solving?
Okay, I'm going to start with a bit of history, actually the actual reason why we started developing LiveCloud. Yes. So LiveCloud has been originally developed at CloudKick. CloudKick is a website, or if I want to use a buzzword, it's a software as a service, which allows users to manage different servers and their infrastructure. Basically, we wanted some way for users to add their servers to our website, and they could manage and monitor all the servers. For example, they could have servers at Amazon, Rackspace, Linode, or any other provider. We basically wanted to expose user interface, which allows users to manage all of their servers through a single website, single web interface. And that's also why we developed LiveCloud, because if you need to communicate with different cloud providers, for example, Amazon, Rackspace, or, I don't know, 20 different providers, all of them have different APIs, which means there's no single library which you could use to talk with them. That's also the reason why we developed LiveCloud. LiveCloud basically is a Python library which allows users to manage their cloud infrastructure. Currently, that's cloud servers, cloud storage, and load balancers using single, simple, and nice-to-use library or API.
Okay, so just to back up again and make sure everybody's with who's listening along at home. So we're talking about something like Amazon EC2, which I've actually mentioned on the show quite a few times already, but that's basically servers that you can start up, small instances or large instances of computing power and disk space and maybe associated databases and stuff. And there's a lot of people probably think of starting it up by just going to the web that's at Amazon's website and pushing the start button. But there's also an API there, right, that I can actually call using some sort of web call. Is it like a REST call or something? How does that get started?
Craig, basically, yeah, different providers have different kind of APIs. Some of them are REST, some of them are SOAP. And basically, yeah, our library exposes a single interface, so you don't need to care if the provider API is some kind of SOAP API, if it returns XML or JSON. You basically just call a method in a library, for example, create server, and you get the server back. It doesn't matter. It basically hides all the API details.
Right. So instead of firing up a machine from the web interface, I have a programmatic need to spin up 10 machines. So I have some sort of API call that I would making. If I'm making directly to Amazon EC2, I'd follow their specifications directly. But the problem that I think that LiveCloud's solving here is that the specifications for that kind of fire up 10 machines is different if I'm using, say, Rackspace instead of Amazon EC2, right?
Yes, Greg. Different providers have different APIs, and there are all kind of differences and some stuff you would never expect. So yeah, we basically hide all the, I could say, ugly stuff, at least in some cases, and expose a nice interface, which works at least 90% of the time.
Now, so we talked a second already about spinning up a machine, obviously one, shutting down a machine, obviously one. What are some of the other things that are in this API that need to be unified across all these providers?
Okay, since the LiveCloud exposes a single interface for all the providers, this means that it's lowest common denominator, which means the base cloud API is actually pretty small. It's around 8 methods. We allow users to create a new server, reboot it, restart it. We also allow them to list the servers to which servers are active. And we also have one function which is pretty nice and useful, which basically allows users to create a server and run some commands on it. Basically, this allows users to bootstrap a server. For example, create a server and install, I don't know, Apache on it or in some kind of config management system such as Puppet and CF Engine, which basically then manage the server. But we expose a nice interface in one or two commands which allows users to create a server and start the bootstrap process.
That sounds very cool. So can you tell us a little bit about what your typical kind of user would be for this? What kind of things are people doing with LiveCloud?
Like I already said, LiveCloud was originally developed at CloudKick, which is a website or software as a server which allows users to manage all of their servers using a single interface. There's another similar company called Server Density. They're basically a monitoring product which also allow users to enter their credentials for different providers, and then they pull all the servers and then can also manage servers from different providers. But most of the time, LiveCloud is used basically as an infrastructure tool. For example, when you want to create, I don't know, you want to start 10 new servers, you use LiveCloud to do that. So usually it's used as an op tool. It's not like in CloudKit case, it's not really exposed. It's used by the op people. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. And I was looking through your website, I noticed that you support version 2.4 of Python to 2.7. Obviously, there's a lot of talk right now in the Python world about Python 3, which is coming down the line. Do you have any plans for that? Have you looked at that, or is it not something that you're worried about at this stage?
Okay, we used to support Python 2.4, but with version 0.5, we dropped support for 2.4 because only some... I mean, most of our people use at least 2.5, so we drop support 2.4, so we now support 2.5, 2.6, 2.7, and PyPy. The problem with Python 3 is it's actually not that easy to support it. At least in our case, because to provide a nice interface, we do some, I could say, ugly stuff with the Python HTTP library, which means that actually making it work in Python 3, it's actually quite hard. One of the way we could do it is we could create like a port, which would only run on Python 3, which would be okay. Mm-hmm. But the problem in this case is we would need two code bases, and obviously that's not ideal and be hard to maintain and stuff like that. So we try to avoid it. In ideal mm-hmm. way, we'd have like a single code base which would work with Python 2.5 on and Python 3, but sadly that's not that easy. We did try to make it work, but we haven't succeeded yet.
Okay, so just as a bit of background for people listening or watching, Python 3 has some kind of backwards compatibility stuff which has been taken away from early versions of Python. So I imagine that's the kind of thing you're talking about. So you're running into problems where the same code will not run on the same in the same way on Python 3 as it would on Python 2.x, which is quite an interesting problem. It's something I was quite curious about. So libcloud is part of the Apache Software Foundation. And I noticed in your little write-up there that you went from being, you helped to kind of guide it from being an Apache incubator project to an Apache top-level project. Can you tell us what exactly those terms mean and what that process was like?
Okay, sure. So libcloud joined the Apache incubator in November 2009. Basically, when a project joins Apache incubator, you get multiple things. One of them is, of course, recognition, right? I mean, if people don't know that there is a thing called Apache that's a foundation, at least people have heard of the Apache web server. So they've heard of it. Mm. Second thing is infrastructure. Apache provides you a ticket tracker when you can manage bugs and stuff like that. It also provides you the SVN repository for code and also hosting for your website and so on. So basically, libcloud has been in the incubator for like a year or so. But then in May 2011, so this year, we finally graduated to a top-level project. Basically, when you're an incubator, you have time to sort if there are any licensing issues and stuff like that. But since libcloud was already released under the Apache 2.0 license, so we didn't really have any licensing issues or intellectual properties. So we didn't have really any hard problems to solve before becoming a top-level project.
Yeah, excellent. And what benefits does it give you being in the Apache Software Foundation? What's the reason for that?
Like I said, one of them is like the recognition, of course, the Apache brand. And other recognition is also help, because Apache has a lot of people who are good or good old open source developers who know how to do open source stuff. And it also provides support for IP issues and stuff like that.
Mm. So you mentioned the license there is Apache 2, 2.0. So why did you choose that license for the project? Was there a particular reason that drew you towards it?
I mean, yes, CloudKick is a proprietary project, so we wanted to use some kind of permissive license like BSD or Apache. And one of the person who works for CloudKick or now Rackspace is Paul Kwerner. He's an old Apache guy, and he also suggested to use Apache 2.0 license.
Mm. Excellent, excellent. So we talked a little bit about projects that are using libcloud. So what do you think is the coolest project that's using libcloud right now? What's the best kind of use of it that you've seen?
So I've recently seen a tweet on Twitter. A guy tweeted that he's working on the Android and iPhone app, which uses libcloud, which is kind of cool, I think, because at least for Android, there isn't like any native environment for running Python stuff. There's like Android scripting environment, but it's not really native. So if someone gets this working, it'd be kind of cool.
Oh, okay, cool. And I noticed while I was doing some research, this is a slightly flippant question, but I noticed while I was doing some research on your list of projects that use libcloud, one of them's called Kraftwerk. And I got very excited, being a music geek, that it might have been the German electro group Kraftwerk, but it's not. It's actually a command line tool. Do you know anything about that or the Kraftwerk project?
There are multiple projects which provide some kind of command line wrapper for using libcloud. One of them is also called LC Tools, so it stands for libcloud tools. It's a project which has been developed by one of the libcloud committers. So basically, you can run all the libcloud actions using your command line interface.
All right, cool.
So I am also curious now, because I'm looking at, I'm sort of wondering why the purpose of libcloud is obviously to unify these APIs. And wouldn't it make more sense for all these providers to provide a common API instead, or is that actually work against their lock-in?
I mean, in ideal world, yeah, every provider would provide a semi API, but sadly, that's not the case. I mean, there are some documents for like the official cloud standards and stuff like that, but it's like 300 pages long PDFs and stuff. It's not like DeepCloud is like a real life pragmatic approach to like cloud standards. So
wait. So we've come up with 300 pages of API description for a standard for something that's as simple as launch your system and connect it up on this IP address and stuff. How can that be 300 pages already?
Yeah, I don't know. It's pretty bad. I've looked at it, and I don't know. It's...
Well, I do know that also, some... go ahead.
So that's also why a lot of people actually like LibCloud. It's like really simple. The base interface, it's easy to use and clean. That's also why, for example, some people which only have servers at Rackspace has a special library for handling their API stuff, but some people still use LibCloud because they like it more, because it's more simple and more easy to use.
And I think, if I'm correct, I think things like OpenStack and OpenNebula are also providing something like an EC2 interface to be compatible as well. If enough of these cloud management servers or intermediate layers start providing that, would that mean that there'd be less and less need for LibCloud?
Yes, that's true. There is like Eucalyptus, which is an open source project, mm-hmm. which basically exposes EC2 compatible API. And some of the cloud providers do use that, but recently more stuff is moving to OpenStack. So maybe, I don't know, in 5 years, if majority of providers will use OpenStack, there won't really be a need for LibCloud. But sadly, I don't think this will happen, at least at this scale.
And obviously you have a sense of the different APIs. Is the EC2 interface like the most broad, or are there things in, say, Rackspaces, and I forget the third guy you mentioned, that wouldn't be represented accurately in EC2?
Yes, the EC2 API is pretty broad. They have a lot of stuff, so I don't know. Probably a lot of stuff could actually be represented using the EC2 API, but the problem is a lot of providers also expose some functionality which is like different or only specific to them, which means it couldn't like really represent it well using the Amazon API.
Okay. So maybe there is a need for having something that's broader than that. Maybe that's what that standards document is sort of the, let's take EC2 and let's add to it everything that everybody else needs as well.
Yeah, it's basically something like that. It's like everything you can think of. That's why it's pretty bad.
Now, as you're developing this, I seem to recall, because I was developing stuff from EC2 and I was looking at the APIs a while back. And as you're developing this, is there a test endpoint you can hit that sort of simulates the what actually happens?
Actually, there is, and that's one of the problems. In ideal words, each provider would at least give you a free account which you could use for testing, but we don't get that, which means we need to use our accounts to test it, which makes it hard. There also isn't like any API or simulator or something like that, which means to actually test it, we'd need to hit the actual API to see everything works properly.
Well, now it seems like that would be a good challenge for everybody who's, providing cloud services to provide some sort of test bed, some sort of sandbox, so that people like you developing the next layer up could have something to actually hit when you need to hit it, right?
Yes, this would definitely help with the development.
Okay, so in the absence of that, when you're testing this thing, you're actually firing up machines and shutting machines down and checking the status. Do you have like an automated test suite for all that?
Actually, we do have a test suite, but in the test suite, we don't do that. Initially, when someone develops the driver, for example, for Rackspace, they test it manually. They manually test it in a CM if everything works. And after that, they save all the responses. For example, the response you get when you call, for example, list nodes, which returns the list of server and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you save this into a file, and the test suite basically loads the responses from a file. We basically have a library which, instead of doing an HTTP request, it loads the response from a file. So we basically use fixtures for tests.
Okay, so you basically can the set of responses and put a, like you said, a fixture in there to intercept it and mock whatever the real thing's doing. Yeah, I was thinking that would be interesting if you actually did the test, and the only way to test it was against the live machines, you would have an actual dollar cost of running your test suite, because it'd be firing up machines, tearing them down, and it'd actually be real money you had to spend to run the sheets or run the tests.
Yep, and also if you had a bug in the code or something like that, and for example, the destroyed node code wouldn't work, yeah, it would means you would have server running.
That's a little crazier. I guess it's probably the same kind of thing that happens when people are like testing car design. You know, they actually have to destroy a few cars into the sides of walls and stuff to figure out if their test suite works. So it's something a little bit like that for you, but hopefully with a little less noise, a little less scariness. Very yep. good. So what are some of the kinds of APIs in this? So it's like you said SOAP, you said REST, and what's the weirdest yeah. one? And how do you isolate that from the higher layers of your code?
Okay, that's a good question. Most of the providers use XML or JSON, but there are some cases, some providers, for example, use like the text-based API. They return the response, which is just a text. And for example, key and values are delimited using a colon, which is like really strange. I don't know why would you invent something like that instead of use JSON, for example. So yeah, ideally, most of the people I know and myself prefer JSON because it's easy to use and also, there are bindings for almost every language. So yeah, we prefer your JSON APIs, but like I said, we also have a lot of XML APIs and stuff like that. So basically, we use for XML and for both for JSON, we use already libraries which are built in Python. For example, for JSON, we use simple JSON, and for XML, which we also use a library which is already provided by Python. But for example, for the text-based APIs and some other change APIs or responses, we basically built our own layer for handling that.
And how much of this coding, when you stare at the specs for, say, Rackspace, and you try to type in an application to make that happen, how much of the debugging is debugging your code because you didn't understand the spec correctly versus the fact that the spec is actually broken?
Yeah, that's also a good question. Yeah, in real life, spec and everything would be correct, but it's usually not the case. For example, we encountered like a really strange problem when developing or using the Rackspace API. For example, they cache responses, which means if we call list node sequentially, very quickly we'll get the same response back, even though if, for example, we created a new server and this server is not included. So for handling cases like that, we basically, in this case, we just send a random token in a query string every time we call. This basically prevents their service from caching the response. And there are a lot of cases like that, which we basically need to hide from the users.
Now, wait a second. Ew. You mean so you're going according to the spec, which says I should be able to call list nodes, and I should get back the currently live list nodes. And somewhere in some server, somewhere this side of the thing that's actually generating that information, they've got a reverse proxy there that's caching this?
Yep, and they're not the only one. A lot of providers do that. So yeah, that's stuff we need to work with.
Why do people make this so hard? There shouldn't be a need for a cache there, because if you're asking for the information, you want it to be current. You don't cache there is really the wrong thing to do. I like your workaround, though. Just add a random token. Oh, it's always my solution to busting caches as well. So good job on coming up with that. No, that's just, I can't believe, yes, I can. How long have I been in the industry? Yes, I can totally believe that they do this, but that just doesn't make any sense. That's just crazy. So you're using standard Python stuff. What's the code size, by the way? How many lines of code? Do you have a sense of that?
That's a good question. I actually don't know. Usually the single driver is around, I don't know, 500 to 1,000 lines of code. Usually the driver code, which is basically a thing which implements the provider-specific logic, it's usually pretty clean because we created some APIs which people who develop drivers can use. So basically the driver code should be pretty clean. So I don't know, the total lines of code, actually, I have no idea. For example, for the compute, we support 25 different providers. So I don't know, 25 multiplied by 1,000, and there's also a lot of core code. It's probably another 5,000 to 10,000 lines of code.
Cool. And sorry, I was cutting across you there. How many people are working on it? How big's your community and so on?
So currently we have around 6 committers, and we also occasionally receive patches from the community, different people who basically work on the libcloud in their free time. Some people use it in the company or for their job, and they contribute patches back. But currently our committer base is around 6 people.
Okay. And do you accept patches from people? You know, if people send you patches and stuff, is that okay? Will you look through them and so on? How open is the project in that sense?
Yes, of course, patches are always welcome. Because it's an Apache project, this means you usually need to use SVN to clone the repository and to basically modify the code, and then you create a patch, and you usually attach it, you send it to the mailing list, or you attach it to the Jira ticket. Jira is basically software which allows you to manage packs. But we also have a GitHub clone, which is basically a clone of repository. We don't manage it. GitHub team manages it. But if you prefer GitHub, you can also use GitHub, fork the project there, and submit a pull request. But since we don't manage the GitHub repository, which this means we'll need to create a patch ourselves. Basically, it means a bit more work for us. So ideally, we prefer the using the Jira or sending a patch to mailing list, but if you really, really like GitHub, you can also do that, and we'll create a patch for you.
Okay, sounds good. So to get a bit of a background to how you got involved in the project and so on, what made you get involved with libcloud and what drew you towards it?
So I was looking for a tool which allows you to manage service, something like really libcloud, and I think I really started getting involved or started to submit patches in around, I think, maybe in November or December 2010. And then I finally become a committer in January 2011.
Okay. And I noticed that you're actually involved with the Ubuntu and FreeBSD communities in Slovenia. So can you tell us a little bit about that? How did you get involved in those?
Sure, yeah. Ubuntu community is actually pretty old. We started it, me and some friends, we just met up on the Freenode on an IRC channel in 2004 or 2005, I think. And we said we need a website which provides help and tutorials for users who use Ubuntu, because of the people on this IRC channel were using Ubuntu, including me. And that's how we started the Slovenian Ubuntu community website, which is pretty big, and it's already been live for like 6 or 7 years now.
I was going to say, 2004, that's pretty early in the history of the Ubuntu project. So you guys must have been straight onto that. So it was already, it took off quickly in Slovenia, Ubuntu?
Actually, Ubuntu is one of the most popular distributions in Slovenia now. And yeah, we have a pretty large user base, and we're pretty proud of that. We also have special team. We also have a special team which handles translations and stuff like that. So we also have quite a lot of contributors there, which is pretty cool.
Oh, excellent. So it sounds like it's actually pretty popular, because one of the things I was curious about is how well things like Ubuntu have done in different parts of the world and so on. And you're also involved with FreeBSD as well. So there's a bit of a crossover there. The Linux guys and the BSD guys never get, you know, into fights and things.
That's true. I use Ubuntu on my desktop, and I prefer using FreeBSD for my server. So I'd say that's two different use cases. I really wouldn't use FreeBSD on my desktop, but I think it's a great choice for your server.
Ah, okay. So how big is say the FreeBSD community over there? Obviously, not as big as Ubuntu, maybe, or bigger or smaller or whatever.
It's a lot smaller. Actually, it's pretty small. We do have some people in Slovenia using FreeBSD, but yeah, it's pretty small compared to the Ubuntu one.
And how's the language? I mean, yeah, I have to confess, I know Randall knows a lot about BSD. I'm being a Linux guy, I'm not that up on BSD. So how is the language support and so on? Because obviously you have different characters and things that you need to use. Is that all supported okay, and you have no problems with that?
And yeah, in Ubuntu, Unicode characters in the Slovenia and locales and stuff, everything is supported pretty well. So lucky there aren't any problems with that anymore.
Excellent, excellent. And you mentioned that you have a lot of people doing translations and stuff as part of the community. So is that quite a big job that you have to spend a lot of time doing?
Yeah, actually, I'm not the guy who organized that, but the guy who usually organizes it, it's called Andre. And yeah, he usually helps people starting with the translations and stuff. So I think they have around maybe 10 active people, but there are also a lot of new people which maybe submit a few translations and then they leave. So yeah, it's growing.
Cool. I'm actually curious about what's your roadmap look like for this? I mean, you're at a 0.5 release or something like that. What does 1.0 look like? How many more API calls do you need, or do you need more breadth in terms of services it provides across different machines? Or what's it look like to 1.0 for this?
Okay, so that's also a good question. First release only supported cloud servers, which means you could only manage your cloud servers. But version 0.5 is a pretty big milestone. This version was released like a few months ago because this version also brought support for cloud storage, for example, services such as Rackspace Cloud Files and Amazon S3. And we also brought the, in 0.5, we also introduced support for load balancers. So yeah, we're slowly expanding.
And do you have, a path? Yeah, what's the plans as you go forward from this?
So yeah, the next thing we'll probably implement is the support for DNS as a service. It's pretty straightforward. That's why it's a good next candidate. There are also other services which could support, for example, like monitoring as a service and stuff like that. But we're probably going to start as with DNS as a service.
Okay. And so when will you decide this is finally 1.0?
Yeah, this will probably happen after the DNS or before that. Because the compute API has been alive for a while now and we haven't like really changed the major API. So we'll probably release 1.0. pretty soon, probably this year.
Okay. And so at this point, Cloud, oh God, I just forgot the name. CloudStack is using it? No, what is it? The first service. Yeah, CloudKick. Because CloudKick's using it. A bunch of people are using it at that level as well. Or is it just, is that really the only service at that level that's using it?
With CloudKick, we still use LibCloud. Currently, we only use it for service, but we do plan to expand and also use it for other services.
And so it is usable. People are using it right now. And when you get to 1.0, it's more of a token milestone then, right?
Yeah, basically, it's mostly just a milestone. Probably the API won't change a lot for 1.0.
And I presume it's, except for having no automated tests that connect live to the systems, I'm sure there's still a test suite for the whole thing, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of tests. Our test coverage is, I don't know, I think it's pretty good. It's around 80%. So, yeah, we have a lot of tests.
That's not bad. And it's all in SVN in the public repo because it's an Apache project, right?
Yep. Like I said, since it's an Apache project, we use SVN, but Apache also provides a Git mirror, which is only a mirror, so you can also use that. And we also have a GitHub clone, but it's preferred to use SVN if you can.
Absolutely, yeah. I know that the OpenOffice people are going through the disaster of having to convert years of Bazaar or Mercurial over to SVN to make that happen. What sort of things are you looking for in terms of maybe people in the audience can contribute to? And you said before the committer size was like 5 or 6. Have you taken patches from other people or has there just mostly just been users of this?
Yeah, we have already accepted quite a lot of patches. Like I said, people range from some people who use it in their free time just for fun, some people who use it in companies or for their jobs. So yeah, we do accept quite a lot of patches. In terms of the contributions, we accept all kind of contributions, but like I said, the support for cloud storage and load balancers was introduced recently, which means we only have a few drivers for those two APIs. So currently, storage drivers or load balancer drivers are especially welcome, but any other kind of patch, if it's a bug fix or improvement or even a computer driver, it's also welcome.
Very good, very good. So I think we've covered almost everything that I wanted to chat about in terms of the conversation. Did we leave anything out that was important to you?
No, I think that's all. So basically, if you want to contribute, you can go to libcloud.org and then you'll find there's a link on website contributing, which basically says how you can contribute. And we also have the IRC channel. It's /libcloud on Freenode. So you can also come there if you have a question or want to talk with us in real time. We're happy to help.
Very good. Now, I don't need to ask Perl versus Python, right? I'm sure you're a Python guy.
Of course. Yeah, Python all the way. Actually, there is some Perl code in the libcloud code base. The website is powered by the Apache CMS, which is written in Perl. I actually developed or helped set up a new website which uses the Apache CMS, so I was exposed to Perl a bit.
I like
Python a lot more.
Don't worry, it'll wash off. It's not really permanent. Don't worry, it'll be fine. People have been tainted by Perl, but only sometimes. It's all good. And I want to, of course, got to ask the other question: Emacs or VI?
VI.
double whammy again this time. Python and VI, not the good stuff. All right, no, it's all good. Whatever works for you. That's what I always keep saying. So, well, great. So it's been a pleasure having you on the show today, talking about LibCloud, and people are going to find out more about it, I'm sure, if it's relevant to what they're doing. So thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Randall. Thanks for having me. I'm a long-time listener, so it's nice to be in the show.
Thank you. Thank you. That was Tomas Maras, whose name I just probably mispronounced again, speaking to us about the LibCloud project from Slovenia, a long ways away from where I'm at right now. Dan, what do you think?
Yeah, interesting stuff. I know it's a buzzword right now, the whole cloud thing, but it is something that is becoming more and more important. And we need ways to interact with it. And I found it was quite interesting that the parallels between LibCloud and something like a traditional database abstraction layer you would use, just to make sure that you don't have to worry about what the databases are doing at a low level. There seems to be a lot of parallels there.
Yeah, it's interesting when you start out with people having their own need to develop, obviously, some API to get it up and running right away. And then eventually people go, yeah, but I don't want to develop just for this one thing. I don't want to be, just working with MySQL. I want to be able to also use my code work with Postgres. And so way back in the early days, in the Perl days, by the way, I can speak with this with some authority, having been back there in those days. The way that Perl would talk to a database is that there was a separate version of Perl to talk to Oracle and a separate version of Perl to talk to MySQL and a separate version of Perl to talk to Sybase. And so that's back in the Perl 4 days. And so what you would do is you would build a special version of Perl. This is back before Perl knew how to do dynamic library loading. And so you'd build a version of Perl called Aura Perl, or you'd build a version of Perl called Sib Perl for Sybase. You'd build a version of Perl called, I don't think MySQL even existed back then. So you'd have these different versions. And not only was it a separate Perl, but the source code was different. So you could call different API calls down at the lowest level. And this was really a mess. And so when Perl 5 came out and had the ability to do dynamic loading, a bunch of people, including Tim Bunst and a bunch of other really great people, got together and said, let's abstract this so that there would be a layer that the code would all call that has like a common interface, which became DBI. And then we'd have dynamically loaded libraries called DBDs, database drivers, that would load in behind that and actually talk using the specific API for each of the things that were there. And it was really a great move forward. And it seems like it's always necessary. It seems like no matter how we develop things, we come up with different APIs and then we add an abstraction layer over the top of it. So this seems like another one of those. And it sounds like a successful project, and hopefully it will help people out at that level. So any other thoughts on that?
I was just going to say that it's also interesting to see that, from me personally being completely biased, that Ubuntu has got such a big hold in Slovenia. I never knew that. So there you go. It's interesting to see how open source is taking off in different places. And not just, obviously you mentioned FreeBSD and other things as well. Sounds like it's doing well over in Slovenia, which is very cool.
Nice. Yeah, and I so appreciate, and I even said this in my Lessons Learned from Flossing Weekly talk, that I so appreciate the internationalization of contribution, that it doesn't matter where you are geographically, you can have a huge impact on the whole world by releasing good open source software and people being able to use that, modify it for their own needs, contribute back so that other people can also benefit from that. It's really great to see this sort of international cooperation breaking down the borders and barriers. And who better to know that than somebody from Slovenia, where the whole country was all upset 10, 15 years ago as well. Should have asked him about that. That would have been interesting. Anyway, so I am now just riffing because I haven't pulled up my guest list yet. And I'm supposed to do this. That was today's awkward transition. It's trying to figure out, I got a map of Slovenia up here. This is not going to work. Okay, because I wanted to figure out where exactly it was in case I was going near it. And it's nowhere near the Black Sea. It's up near the north end of Italy. And so I actually have been there. I've been to some place in Slovenia already, which is sort of cool. On one of my cruises, I will go there. So on the upcoming guest list, it's a little short right now because I'm just beginning to book Q4, and we've got a bunch of slots open. I've sent out a bunch of emails to waiting for people to kind of land in there a little bit. But we do have a couple of people still scheduled for this quarter. Next week, I'm going to be on a cruise ship. So we've got Aaron Newcomb in the big chair. Randy Harper is going to join him because it's a FreeBSD day, which is Chris Moore is going to come in and talk about PCBSD, which is the version of FreeBSD that has all the nice desktop stuff, a nice desktop installer, already comes with X11 packages built, that sort of thing. So I'm glad there's somebody there to hold down the fort while I am out at sea. Oddly enough, I'll be passing by almost directly, laterally across from Petaluma about the time the show is being taped. So if I could somehow beam a signal over from the cruise ship that I'll be on, I might actually be able to be on the show, but I don't think I'm going to do that. That's not going to happen.
How loud can you shout?
Maybe they'll set up a telescope, right? And telescope and a big giant ear mics, right? Exactly. No, that's not going to happen. after that, I'll be back again for Jonathan Ellis and Cassandra. Cassandra being one of those wonderful key value stores, high performance key value stores. Originally, I think developed at Facebook, handed over to the Apache project. So another Apache project coming up, which is nice. I did like the fact that he was talking about all the services that Apache provides, and I hadn't realized yet, but yes, visibility is a really important one. I mean, once you get to be part of the Apache family, you're listed there along with 50 or 60 other really great projects, and it sort of gives some credentials to the fact that you're probably going to stick around for a while, unlike some of the other projects that might not have made it that far. I also have rescheduled. I was going to have, following week, I was going to have Jeffrey Thalhammer talk to us about Perl Critic, which if you know the C thing of lint, it's like lint for Perl. It goes through and analyzes the source text of your Perl program, looking for things that are likely to be problems, much more than, say, the -W warnings would tell you. So I really wanted to have him on right away, but I'm going to be gone that week. So instead, what I've done is I moved him down to a place that I can actually speak to him at, and he's down in fourth quarter. We've got a bunch of other people to shortlist, FreeNAS, MariaDB, TMUX, the Vega Security Tester, Eucalyptus Systems, Open Source at the New York Times, Chef, Erlang, all sorts of stuff going down the list. So you'll just have to stay tuned. If you want to know when we schedule those people, first off, you can go to twit.tv/floss. Our website there will redirect to a much longer, harder to remember URL, but twit.tv/floss still works. And I'm just going to keep saying the short one. And if you go there, there's a spreadsheet linked from there that tells about upcoming guests and what we've got on the plan. You can follow us on Identica at Floss Weekly. You can also follow us on Twitter at Floss Weekly. And as I start booking guests, I immediately tweet or dent, whatever you call it. You call it denting? Is that how it's said?
Yep, denting, yep.
Well, what a weird term. Anyway, so you can either watch for the tweets and dents from Floss Weekly. We have a blog, too, as well, flossweekly.posterous.com, and you get longer explanations there. But normally the short tweets also point at the longer blog. We did have a chat room going today, and we've got some of the questions from the chat room because that's how we roll. If you want to follow us while we're doing the live show, it's live.twit.tv at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time. That's Pacific Time US. We like to call that Leo time. It's because that's where Petaluma is. That's where Leo is. Let's see what else on my list. You can follow me at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. I'm on both Identica and Twitter, although I actually don't post anything to Identica. I just simply... I think my tweets go over to my Identica as well. I think that's how I got set up. If you follow me, you also find out that I'm going to be in Vancouver, British Columbia tomorrow night if you're watching this show live. Oh, wait, no. September 9th. September 9th? 8th. 9th. What is today? Today's the 7th.
It's the 7th.
Okay, so tomorrow night, the 8th. I don't know why I typed 9th into my notes here. This is just horrible. They should fire me. What a bad job of a host I do sometimes. Okay, September 8th, I'll be in Vancouver, BC for the evening as the beginning of the cruise that I'm going to take off out of there the next day, MacMania 12. We've got a bunch of really great people on that cruise. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going down the coast from Vancouver to San Diego. But that evening, I'll probably try to figure out if I can tweet or something about where I'm going to be meeting up there. At worst, the Pan Pacific Hotel Lobby Bar. I think that's probably going to where we're going to end up. So you might as well hang out with us if you're in the Vancouver, BC area and want to meet up with a fellow Floss Weekly listeners. But more importantly, I'll be also in Seattle September 12th. Not sure what I'm doing there yet. I've been to Seattle so many times in my life that I don't think really need to get a shore excursion in Seattle. I think I've pretty much been every place. So I'll probably be somewhere close to the dock out of there, try to find some Wi-Fi bar or something nearby. But watch my tweets for that. And most importantly, coming up the next week, if you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, a bunch of us are going to get together at the Mint Karaoke Club. That's themint.net on September 14th, probably starting around 7 p.m. For a meetup. And that should be a lot of fun. I'm going to have a great time there, I'm sure, because it's karaoke. That's what I do. So a lot of fun there. A bunch of people there. We're going to get Fun Crunch, that's a regular listener of this show. She's in the chat room going, woohoo, karaoke. So I know we're all going to hang out. It's going to be a great time. And I think that's all the things I want to plug, except, you know, follow me, which I already said. So I guess that's what I'm done plugging. Dan, your turn to plug.
Yeah, so, well, first thing I should plug, really, is the fact that you were on Linux Outlaws recently, Randall. Episode 227, if you go to linuxoutlaws.com, you can find us on there, and you can hear our, I think, hour-long chat with Randall. We kept that going quite a while. It was a lot of fun. He even wore a black hat, which was cool.
I think it's almost 2 hours, actually. Thing. It was almost 2 hours. Yeah, it was like an hour. The podcast is like almost 2 hours. And you only had a little bit at the end for a song. So I think it was about an hour and 45-minute interview with me, which is scary.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you want to check that out, go to linuxoutlaws.com and you'll be able to find it in the list there. As I say, it's episode 227. Obviously, if you want to find out anything more about what I'm doing, you can read my blog and other things where I regularly write all kinds of updates. If you go to danlynch.org/blog, you can find all that there. And also, if you want to follow me on Identica or Twitter or any of those places, the username is @methoddan. That's like the two words method and Dan stuck together. People think that's a programming reference, but I'm sad to say it's not actually. I'm an old school hip hop fan, and that's what it's about. But you can also find me on Google Plus as well. If you search for Dan Lynch on Google Plus, there's quite a few of us on there. It's quite a popular name, but you'll see a picture of a guy wearing a red hat, fedora, holding a red guitar. That's me. So you can add me on there. In the upcoming weeks, I'm going to be at PyCon UK, which close your ears for a second, Randall. It's a Python conference. it's going to be in Coventry in the UK. It's the 24th and 25th of September, the weekend. And I've actually been asked to speak after dinner, which is going to be interesting. So I don't know what I'm going to talk about, but that's going to be very fun. And I also might be playing the guitar and singing. So if there's any Floss fans in the UK who want to come along to that, you need to get to Coventry in the Midlands on the 24th and 25th of September. I think there might be some places left at PyCon as well. I'm not 100% sure, but if you go to pyconuk.org, you can find out more there. And obviously don't forget to check out all the other stuff like Linux Outlaws, Rat Hole Radio. I think that's enough of a plug for now.
All good. So did you say where to find the Linux Outlaws show? Linuxoutlaws.org, right?
.com. Yeah, or .com, org, that works as well. Okay, it works as well. We've got all the domains near enough.
Yeah, thanks again for having me on that show, because the previous time it was also an interesting number. So this was episode 227. Previous one was 117. And so I guess the next time is 337, right? You're going to have me back on another 110 shows?
Yeah, that's quite a way off, though. That's like 2 years away, I think. Is that? Yeah.
Well, that's along between these two. That's along between these two. So, you know, it works out that way. By the way, you also mentioned Google Plus. Apparently, Dan and I are both blessed with having an infinite number of Google Plus invites. So if you want to get a Google Plus invite, you don't have one yet. Now I'm starting to dread saying this, because I must have processed about 75 Google Plus invites over the last 3 weeks. But it's no problem. I have an infinite number. You just have to have a little bit of patience if you send an email to me. So send an email to me. I prefer email at merlin@stonehenge.com. But if you find me on Google instead, there's a Gmail address for me as well. Just go ahead and send me. But it has to be a gmail.com address. Gmail.com. address. So if you don't have one of those, go get one of those first, then go ahead and tell me and I will add you to Google Plus. No problem with that. And I'm hanging out there. I actually found a way to hook that, and Dan, you might be interested in this. I found a way to hook that into Twitter and Facebook. So it's called Plusist, PLUSIST.com. And so once you register under that for free, all my posts originating in Google Plus are also automatically tweeted and sent to Facebook with an appropriate landing page link if it's too long to actually fit in 140 characters. So very, very nice stuff there. So I'm glad I got that back. There was another service before that was doing that, and then they went under. It didn't work for very much longer. Okay, well, I think we've spent enough time here talking about ourselves, although I like to do that occasionally. I think it's probably enough. In fact, I hear the music coming up, so it must be time to wrap up here. So we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.